I get the introduction part, and I guess I would consider myself pretty special as a freshman representative getting to introduce the senior senator from Missouri. So today we're blessed to have Senator Roy Blunt with us, native of Niangle, Missouri. Anybody out there, I'm sure we've gone on some float trips down the good old Niangle River. You might know his son Matt was the Missouri State Governor from 2005 to 2009. And I actually had the honor of working with a couple of his other kids down in Jefferson City, Amy and Andy. They're lobbyists down there and really great to work with. So when I first heard the senator was not going to seek re-election, I was like, I wonder how long he's been involved in politics. Well, let me take you all the way back to 1973. Started out as the Greene County Clerk, and if you don't know counties, that would be where Springfield is at. Served there for 12 years. Then in 1984, elected twice to be Secretary of State. Then in 1997, seeked a U.S. Representative for the 7th Congressional District. Served there from 97 to 2010. And then 2010 became one of our senators through today. And he's members of the Appropriations Committee, Committee of Science and Transportation, and also on the Select Committee of Intelligence. I'm guessing you probably can't give us too many secrets off that one, can you? No? Okay, doggone it. But like I said, honored, very, very honored to have the senior senator from Missouri, Senator Roy Blunt. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kurt. Thank you. Great to be here. I've been in Saline County lots of times, but I've never been in this building before, and I think it must not have been here all that long. I would have probably been here before. But great to be with you. Listening to Kurt's introduction, sounds like it's about time I decided to move on and do something else. And I'm going to be doing that at the end of next year, but really look forward to everything we can do this year and all of next year to continue to make a difference for our state. And by we, I mean all of us working together. People work in the state legislature, at the county courthouse, at the city hall. I'm glad to be here. I want to spend some time listening, and I'm not scheduled to be here a long time, so don't let me talk forever. Let me mention two or three things. One is, it's nice to be here with you and to all be at a meeting without worrying about the virus as much as we did for a year and a half. And it sort of led to some disconnectedness, I think, all around. I did lots of virtual events, but there's a difference in virtual events and events where you're in the room with other people, and I'm glad we're getting back to these kind of events again. You know, lots of challenges in the last year. A lot of people had behavioral health problems, mental health issues, addiction issues that were moving in the right direction. Suddenly that isolation and that lack of the support group you had that was helping you get through that. So I've spent a lot of time on all those issues in the Congress. I would say, on our efforts against opioid addiction, we were seeing drug overdose deaths go down every year for three straight years. And then in 2020, we hit the highest number of drug overdose deaths ever in the country. And again, people had other challenges there, just the isolation and the worry of sickness of yourself or others, or being at home. Kids who were not in school in person had lots of challenges, and hopefully we're all moving beyond that and thinking about what we can do to bring everybody else beyond that with us. The vaccine, amazing, and the ability to get that done and get that done as quickly as we got it done. Part of that was based on healthcare research that we've worked on for a long time. I chaired the committee for 6 years. I'm the top Republican on that committee now, which is evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, that funds the National Institute of Health. And the research that we've done, made it possible for us to do things that nobody would have thought possible, both in developing tests so that there'd be more testing, and as you know, at school, at Missouri Valley College, or anybody else, anywhere else, we're going to have tests for a while after we think we're well beyond the most dangerous part of the virus, and then developing vaccines. 2 years would have been a record. 3 years is what it's generally taken to develop a vaccine. 2 years would have been the record. People were getting shots in their arms about 12 months after we actually first identified what this unique virus was, which was a pretty amazing thing. And one of the things we did there, and I think eventually the Trump administration will get some credit for this when you look back at what happened, is with congressional support, and by the way, we passed five bipartisan bills last year in a Congress that had a Republican Senate and a Democrat House, with virtually no credit being given for working together. All the criticism is, well, you guys never worked together on anything. We passed five bills, frankly, about something that we were just guessing on. But in one of those five bills, before I lose my train of thought here, in one of those five bills, we made it possible to set up a system to where we were going to buy vaccines, whether they were approved or not. Now, that sounds kind of crazy. Why would you buy vaccines, whether they were approved or not? And the reason was, if we thought a vaccine had a likelihood of being approved, more likely to be approved or not, we made arrangements. We will buy the first 100 million of that vaccine. And, you know, if it somehow didn't work, and we haven't had any of that happen yet, we'll buy the first 100 million doses of that vaccine. So you go ahead and begin to prepare the vaccine even before it's approved to be given to anybody. Now, you've got a 30,000 person trial going on during that, and you can kind of begin to tell early in that trial whether this is likely to work or not. But not only did we get a vaccine approved in less than 12 months, we got a vaccine approved and had tens of millions of copies of that vaccine immediately available when it was approved. Normally you'd have vaccine approval and then 6 months later you'd have vaccines. So if we'd followed any normal path, even with a one-year record on developing a vaccine, we'd be getting the first vaccines delivered about next month. But the way we did it, we had vaccines available at the end of December and early January, and 50% of all Americans are vaccinated now. I'd certainly advise getting vaccinated, but I wouldn't be for a law that required people to get vaccinated. But I got vaccinated as soon as I was eligible to get a vaccine, and I would think that would be the best thing to do. But you'll have to, if you haven't done that, you'll have to make that decision on your own. And there may be some health circumstance or something I don't know about where there's a vaccine challenge in your family, or I don't mean a psychological challenge. I mean really a challenge where people have had vaccines and always had a bad result. Let me say one other thing about the vaccines. The first two vaccines developed were vaccines developed like no other vaccine anybody's ever had. So if you had the Pfizer vaccine, which is what I had, or the Moderna vaccine, you had a vaccine that didn't give you the virus. You know, everybody in here who's my age, which would be about 10 people, anybody who, so you mentioned I was first elected to county office in 1973.
I didn't want to give up your age.
Which is quite a while ago. Now, the good news is I was only 23 in 1973, but it is what it is. But I've got a smallpox shot. You know, we used to line up at school and have a smallpox shot. And the year we all lined up at the Stratford Elementary School, for whatever reason, they wanted to give them in our back shoulder. So my smallpox scar is back there. Most of you my age have your smallpox scar right here. But, you know, that vaccine, I got a little smallpox, and that's what gave me the immunity to smallpox. On the two vaccines I just mentioned, they really tell your system, this is what you should look out for, and when it happens, here's what your system should do. So this what's called is NRA. It's an NRA vaccine, which really tells your system, here's how you fight back this particular virus the minute you see it. And we've done other things with immunotherapy, where people that have cancer and leukemia have great success. That's all happened in the last 6 years, where you change, where you amp up the T cells in your own system that fight cancer if cancer is attacking you. None of this was happening 10 years ago. So great progress in those areas. Now, two or three current things. One is we all need to be thinking about what we can do to have better roads, bridges, highways, ports, airports, water system, the traditional infrastructure above ground and underground is what I'd be for the federal government doing everything we could to encourage. There's a big debate in Washington right now. The administration, I think knowing that infrastructure is a pretty popular thing, would like to call everything infrastructure. And I'm not for that. Doesn't mean I'm against everything that wouldn't be infrastructure. I'm just against having it in an infrastructure bill. You know, if we're going to have required pre-kindergarten, maybe that's a debate to have, whether the federal government should pay for it's another debate to have, but that's not infrastructure. You know, whether older Americans need more health care at home, let's have that debate, but let's not say that's infrastructure. And so that's kind of one debate right now. And then the other debate would be what to do about the 2017 tax policies, which I personally think we're off to a pretty good start at the beginning of the pandemic, and would hate to see those tax policies change till we really give them a chance to work. And the prayer earlier, we prayed for our farmers. One of the proposals in changing tax policies is to eliminate the $11 million exemption for inheritance tax and go back to $1 million. And $1 million, you would still pay capital gains tax on whatever your property was worth today, as opposed to what the person you inherited from gave for it. So anybody that knows much about family farms in Missouri or small businesses, either one, that'd just be a nightmare to ever figure out, in many cases, what it was worth at the time. Another one, just trying to figure out, okay, really, who created all the wealth here? Was it your dad and mom, or was it you working alongside your dad and mom for 30 years to continue to grow their farm or their business? I'm opposed to that as well. But I'm for some things, and I know this is a community. Last time I was here, we were talking about broadband. Critically important that we have access to broadband. If we didn't know that before, surely after virtual school and the appropriate move to telemedicine, we understand how critically important broadband is. And also people working at home, you know, a lot of people would like to live in a community like Marshall or near Marshall if they could be connected to the economy that they'd like to be part of and could be now. We know in ways maybe we didn't quite know before. But I believe we were doing that here through the municipal system, which doesn't happen very many places, but I think we're making great progress, and I'd be glad to hear about that. Let me listen for a while. But thank you for letting me work for you. Thank you for letting me be here with you today. Thank you for helping me understand in the next few minutes what I ought to be thinking about as I think about what needs to be happening in Saline County and in Marshall and that whole big area that Marshall serves in a lot of ways. So thank you all.
All right, you guys had some questions. I think we're going to start off with Bradley over there.
So, Bradley Shadd with Missouri Corn Growers Association. First off, thank you for being a wonderful senator and representing Missouri well for all those years. You mentioned one of the key things that we're looking at is the death tax and how difficult that's going to be for not only Curtis coming up, but Brandon Teal is going to be on my board here shortly. And as they look to that, where do we stand on that is my first question. And secondly, you talked about the infrastructure bill and there's more incentives out there for electric vehicles than what there is for actual infrastructure.
Right.
And there's a lot of people sitting around here that can't afford an electric vehicle out here in outstate Missouri, and plus we don't have the infrastructure for it. But we do have a methanol plant that is producing jobs and everything, and getting the automotive industry the benefits they need to be able to produce an internal combustion engine that can run on higher blends of ethanol. Do you have any things that we could level the playing field on to help rule Missouri out?
Well, on the death tax, which I mentioned, we've worked really hard. When I went to the Congress 25 years ago, it was $1 million, and it was about 45% of everything after that. And the nightmare for families that were inherited, again, things that, that many times so much of the wealth was created by working right there on your family farm or in your family business. We've all, almost everybody thinks the death tax was unfair. We finally got it up to the equivalent of about $11 million for a couple, which exempts most people from the death tax. And if you're above that, you normally figure out very complicated ways you don't have to pay it anyway. And there's always been a fight about the so-called stepped-up basis. And the stepped-up basis means you inherit not at the value that whoever you're inherited from gave for it, but the value it is today. So, you know, my dad died 3 or 4 years ago, and our little farm east of Springfield, my brother and I inherited that at today's value without ever having to go back and figure out what in that particular, my mom and dad gave for that farm 50 years ago. And thank goodness we didn't have to do that. So we're going to continue to fight that. It's unfair. I don't think, if they do that, they'll have to do that with 50 Democrats and the vice president. And I don't believe they'll be able to figure out how to get that done. So, but it's something to be on high alert about. And on infrastructure, it does need to be, as I said, what traditionally we thought infrastructure should be. And frankly, I think as we move, you made a good point to the electric vehicle credits that they're proposing, $100 billion worth of electric vehicle credits, and the electric vehicle fueling stations, charging stations, had more money, there was more for that in the original bill than roads, bridges, and highways. You know, so unacceptable. And I don't know if our bipartisan effort, 4 or 5 Republican senators, in, which includes me, have been working with them to try to say, okay, we can make a bipartisan bill here if you want to. And it can be big in terms of money, but it also can be appropriate in terms of infrastructure normally pays for itself. So, you know, all of us who drive our car or truck up to a gas pump and put gas in that gas pump, you pay gas tax. If you charge your car at your house, which is okay with me if that's what you want to do, but you don't pay any tax to drive on the road. So, you know, we told the president we think we ought to include as some fee for electric vehicles, whether it's so much a year or a miles driven tax, which in a lot of Missouri gets you automatically, everybody gets their tentacles up on that. Some way that if you're driving down the road in a gas-powered vehicle and the same weight vehicle behind you is powered by electricity, you're paying for the road for both of you. And so, you know, at the very least, we ought to figure out right now how to get everybody on the road and continue to pay for the road. We've got a little problem with the gas tax anyway because vehicles have frankly gotten more efficient. So the same number of miles driven produces less money than it did the last time Missouri voted to increase gas tax. But that's a, you know, I think most of the infrastructure in the country was generally designed to somehow pay for itself. You know, your water bill over 30 or 40 years, you pay for whatever the last improvement was they did if you have that kind of water service. Your electricity, obviously, you pay for the electric infrastructure that's in place, so you stretch it out in a way that makes it reasonable. So you should be very, very in tune to this fight about the death tax and really think about what's in the bill that the administration eventually may call, this is our infrastructure bill, and we're gonna try to do it, we're just gonna try to do it with 50 votes, and I won't be voting for that, so I guess the headline could be, you know, Blunt votes against infrastructure bill, but Blunt will not be voting against roads, bridges, ports, airports, water systems, any of the things we're prepared to add broadband to that. You know, it wasn't initially part of what the federal government would have thought was infrastructure, but neither were airports. But it fits that definition of what we've always thought you can't do by yourself, but is necessary for us to function all together. So, what else?
I just want to make a couple comments and a couple questions and a couple requests. A lot of people in the room wouldn't know that the Corps of Engineers every year gets 6 new starts in the country, and that 2 of them came to Missouri this year through your efforts. One of them was the flood study, which has been critical for all of our farmers, and the other is the Lower Missouri River Navigation Study. We're so appreciative for that. In March of 2020, AgriServices of Brunswick, I'm with AgriServices of Brunswick. We're the largest port on the Missouri River in terms of employees, tons moved. We got a grant from the Missouri Department of Agriculture Small Business Development Association to do a container on barge feasibility study. We used the results of that study to apply for a project designation through MARAD with MoDOT as our sponsor. Every port in Missouri, on the Missouri River, is listed in that project designation. I was on a MARAD call yesterday, and they said that the project designation approvals have been sent to Secretary of Transportation's office, and they're waiting for his signature. Notice of funding is out, and applications are due June 25th, and they are not sure if he will sign them by then or not. And they said if we knew anybody that could...
Well, we'll see. I'm for that. You know, I'm for, I'm for that.
To sign
them. Okay, and Sarah Grapp, who runs our Mid-Missouri office, is here. Is working on that. And Hannah Larrick is here, and so we're going to help on that.
Sure, appreciate it. My other comment, and I've talked to people in the past about this and haven't gotten much traction, I am opposed to the Omaha District and the Kansas City District being managed out of the Northwest District in Portland, Oregon, and I think it's ridiculous that we're not managed out of the Mississippi Valley Division, and if there's anything you can do to help push us in that direction. We're a whole system, as you know, and it's not being managed. In my humble opinion.
I hear you. You know,
that way, and the resources the Mississippi Valley Division has that could benefit our system would make a huge difference.
It's a challenge. You know, we have the Mississippi, we have the Omaha, we have the Kansas City office, St. Louis office, two other core groups we deal with. You could certainly simplify the core, there's no doubt about that. But they have been pretty good, particularly on the Missouri issues over the last 3 or 4 years of being supportive of what you and I think needs to happen on the Missouri. So we'll see. We'll look at the, and Sarah's mentioned that to me before. Go ahead.
Yes, Senator Blunt. I'm Amy Weber. I'm with Fitzgibbon Hospital in Marshall, Missouri. I want to go back to COVID a little bit because from a healthcare perspective, that impacted us tremendously. We're one of the largest employers in the county. We have 480 employees and a payroll and benefits of about $32 million that we put into the local economy. Through the PPP program, first of all, thank you for speaking in our behalf. We did get about $5 million through that program. So through all of COVID, we did not have to cut anybody. We did reduce hours, but we didn't have to cut anybody. During COVID, we administered about 17,000 tests. We became a regional testing center. We did another 8,500 rapid tests. We saw 100 patients in our hospital that were positive with COVID-19 and treated another 25 patients with monoclonal antibodies. And then during all of the vaccinations, we administered an astounding 14,000 vaccinations because we were able to deploy the resources to get that done together with our community partners like Missouri Valley College and our health department. Through all this, what really kept us afloat was the legislation that you spoke about. We took $11.5 million in stimulus funds. The problem for us now that after we took that money based on the guidance that Congress had attached to it at the time, now CMS has changed the rules. It's a moving target, so we're having to hire consultants to come in and help us attest to whether we are able to keep that money. So we're reluctant to spend those funds because we might have to be asked to give them back. So I don't know what you can do with CMS to change, they changed the rules since the funds were given to us. So we really, that's a quandary for us. And it's a a big problem for small hospitals like ourselves that now we don't know whether we're going to have to pay that money back or not.
It is a problem, and it's a problem we shouldn't be having. I've talked to the new person at CMS who just got confirmed about this specifically. If you need to go back to what you told people initially, then that needs to be the standard. So we are very engaged in that. And again, I've chaired the committee for 6 years that funds them. And they're difficult, even when you control their money. CMS is just difficult. Every time I hope the new administrator will be better than the last administrator. It never seems to work out that way, but I have lots of discussions with them. I am on this, and you are exactly right. So hopefully we can get that. Hopefully we'll reach the conclusion that you think that they should reach and do it quickly so you'll know what to do. So, thanks for that. By the way, the PPP program, it was just a pure guess on our part, frankly. We were guessing the whole process through all five of those bills, and particularly on the first one. And the PPP idea, the payroll protection plan for businesses initially of less than 300 people, eventually more than that, our view, better to keep people on your payroll where they know that when this is over, they've got a job to come back to, than let everybody go to unemployment. And then you've got to, they wonder if they're going to come back, and you wonder if they're going to come back. And I think it worked remarkably well. And we did a couple of things that didn't work so well, that didn't really cost anything because they worked so badly that nobody could use them. But we had to keep going back to that program, one, changing the guidelines, and two, adding more money to solve certain more people, in some cases extended a little longer, and others just to be sure more people got a chance.
We'll get one more question, and then.
Senator, thank you for your service over these, past years or whatever.
The relatively short time I've been in public.
Couple things, whatever. I think about every business represented here is struggling with labor. If you're not struggling with labor, you're dealing with somebody that hasn't got enough labor, can't get the product, can't get this, that. Costs are going up on everything. To me, this seems like the late 70s or whatever right now. And you're old enough to remember what the early 80s was like.
That's as we pointed out.
Yeah. To me, anything we can do to get people back to work, we had people that, went to unemployment. I've known people that went to unemployment, they're staying home, and it's very difficult for businesses today. And I'm not saying what we did last year wasn't good, but there's got to be an incentive for people to come back to work. And it's running, I hear that every day, from the different businesses. The other thing, one issue like we have is, the pork packing plants or whatever used to be able to run in the lines speed of 1106, and the judge just decided that, that was the limit. And then we had a judge that said, we've had plants running for about 2 decades now at higher speeds than that, with less injuries per employee. And then a judge has decided that, we just got changed to allow us to go to higher speeds, and then a judge has knocked that down, so now we have to go back to 1106 here sometime this summer. And it's probably not a problem right now, but when we get into this fall or whatever, that might be a problem. We got more pigs available than we have the ability to process. So ours are going to be worth less because they don't need them. And then there might be a shortage on shelter because of it. And I don't know why a judge can decide this, whatever, with 20 years of history, but anything you can do on that.
Yeah,
appreciate it. But the labor situation is, I think you could ask about anybody in this room, is just critical right now.
Okay. Well, I think I'm on a fairly short leash here. I've done about 6 events today. I'm going to do 2 more. But I'm glad to be here. I'm going to kind of finish up on this. One on judges. You could certainly make the case that the Senate may do nothing as the Senate does this, not the Congress, more important than confirming federal judges. And I think we've been pretty focused the previous 4 years on not just at the Supreme Court level, but every level, of trying to put judges on the bench whose job was to, who would, in all likelihood, try their best to determine what the law said, not what they, or the Constitution said, not what they thought it should say. And that kind of judge would not have made that kind of ruling. So it's really important we stay focused on these things. What does that matter? It matters for a lifetime. You know, the three Supreme Court judges we put on the bench replaced judges who had all been there more than two decades. They may have all, well, the first two, the Republican judges that were replaced were nominated by Ronald Reagan, and they both served 13 years after, not just 13 years after he left office, but then another 13 years after he died. So if you talk about long-term impact or something, judges of that long-term impact. In the last month in the state, I would say the two things I've heard the most are all of our input costs are going up, the inflationary concerns, and we can't get help. Both of those may be driven by the federal government. We have put, at the end of the day, way too much money into the system. And they're proposing a whole lot more. You know, so far, the administration has proposed, since the first of the year, outside of the budget, $7.1 trillion of spending, which in real dollars, today's dollars, is more than we spent to fight World War II. And we've got some challenges, but we are not facing a World War II challenge at this moment. And they're talking about that, spending more money than we spent then, and all in sort of, and about four times as much as we would spend in a normal spending year in the discretionary parts of the budget. We spend about $1.5 trillion a year that we fight over, how much of it's gonna go to defense, and how much of it's gonna go to everything else that's discretionary. $1.5 trillion. They propose spending $7.1 trillion in addition to that. They're saying some of it will finance by eliminating the tax cuts, and some of it will just borrow the money, like the first $2 trillion that they did with 50 Democrats and the vice president. And so you know, we're driving some of that inflation. And then on the unemployment, I was actually always opposed to the enhanced unemployment. We tried to take it out, and it was in the bills before the one this year. And we could never quite get close, but we couldn't get enough votes to get it out once it got in the House bill. And obviously had to move forward with the package we needed to do for testing the vaccines and other things. Last month in the country, the average unemployment in the average state was $618 a week. $618 a week. $318 of that would have been the state unemployment benefit, and the other $300 was the $300 that the federal government was saying, we think you should add this to your unemployment benefit. Well, that's just more money than a lot of people make, or than a lot of jobs pay. And it's actually more than 15, it divides into $15.46 an hour, but the bill also made quite a bit of it unusually untaxable. So it's you know, maybe 20, but it's more than a lot of jobs in our side of state pay. And so it's a challenge, particularly if you've got, you know, there are a lot of reasons people aren't rushing back to work. One is kids in school with schools that weren't going to school, or kids who hadn't been in school and decided they wanted to stay virtual, you know, but this is the biggest reason, I think. And so our governor and at least 20 other governors have announced they've either already quit taking the money or we're quitting the money this right now. And was it June 1 or June 2 for the first week of June? Something like that. It's within a few days if they haven't already done it. So people will start getting a $300 check, $318 in the average state. I think that's about where we are. But they'll get that check rather than a $600 check. And so suddenly that job that they keep calling saying, we got a job here if you'll come and do it, might be more appealing than it has been. So part of this is just caused by the government not thinking about the unreasonableness of paying people more to stay home than to go to work. And that's almost always going to result in more people staying home, any way you look at it. So I think, you know, we need to move on. I think hopefully the inflationary issue is short term. We're going to have to watch it really carefully because it may not be short term. And that can be a real problem for families to, and businesses both, because initially you just pass along a lot of the inflation. You just absorb it rather, because you can't pass it along. And then eventually people start not doing things that they otherwise would have done because they don't have the money to do them. And neither of those are good things. So, all right, I think I've got to go. Anything else you all want to say or I need to hear?
Well, we have just one final question for you.
All right, one final. I thought that was a final
question. No, you get one from me. Okay. What can we do as Saline County citizens to help you? What can we do for you?
Well, I think the best thing you can do for us is with Hannah and Sarah, do everything you can to get the information we need about what we ought to be doing. Stories to tell. You know, I was on the floor talking about this issue the other day, and I talked to a friend of mine who runs Silver Dollar City in Branson, and he said, we could hire 150 people tomorrow if we could just find them. We would hire them in the morning if we could find them. Or the guy I talked to who runs a hotel chain here in the state said, our customers are back, largely. We can't clean enough rooms, so we can't rent all our rooms because we don't have the customers to clean the rooms. Those are good stories to tell, so you're not just talking about what you imagine is happening, but what you know is happening. And then on issues like the port issue and the bridge issues and things like that, keep talking to us about it. That's the thing to do in case it's most helpful.
Wonderful.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you all.